Good afternoon. I am Condra Williams, and I'm representing the Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity with the Emergency Risk Communication Branch and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I'd like to welcome you today to today's COCA call, the role of healthcare professionals in protecting older adults against influenza. You may participate in today's presentation via webinar, or you may download the slides if you are unable to access the webinar. The PowerPoint slide set and the webinar link can be found on our COCA webpage at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Free continuing education is offered for this COCA call. Instructions on how to earn continuing education will be provided at the end of the call. CDC, our planners, presenters, and their spouses and partners wish to disclose that they have no financial interests or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. Planners have reviewed content to ensure there is no bias. Dr. Groskopf would like to note that the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices recommends that those with a history of severe allergic reaction to egg receive any licensed, recommended, age-appropriate influenza vaccine. However, this is a labeled contraindication in the package inserts of egg-based flu vaccines. After the speakers have presented, you will have the opportunity to ask the presenters questions. You may submit questions at any time through the webinar system by clicking the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen and then typing your question. For those who have media questions, please contact CDC Media Relations at 404-639-3286 or send an email to media@cdc.gov. If you are a patient, please refer to your healthcare provider for questions. At the end of this COCA call, the participants will be able to describe the phenomenon of immunosenescence and how the immune system grows weaker with aging, discuss the importance of safe and effective influenza vaccines specifically developed for adults age 65 years and older, describe resources available to help healthcare professionals talk with adult patients about specific influenza vaccines most beneficial for them. Today's first presenter is Dr. Lisa Groskopf. Dr. Groskopf is a medical officer in the influenza division of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where she serves as the CDC lead for the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices Influenza Workgroup. Our second presenter is Dr. William Schaffner. Dr. Schaffner is the medical director of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases and a professor of Preventative Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in Nashville, Tennessee. He serves as a hospital epidemiologist at Vanderbilt University Hospital. He also serves as the NFID liaison to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and is a member of the Influenza Vaccine Working Group. At this time, please welcome our first presenter, Dr. Groskopf.
Thank you. So I'm going to provide basically a surveillance overview. Most of this is going to be a summary of the 2016-17 season. I was asked to give a preview of what we expect for 17-18, but it's unfortunately a little too early to project. We'll get into a little bit more about that later. Just a sort of a summary of the 16-17 season. Peak activity occurred nationally in mid-February, which is not an uncommon period for peak. Most seasons will peak sometime between January, February, occasionally March, occasionally December, but January, February are the most common months. However, as is not uncommon in the U.S., it's a big country, there were regional differences. Western regions peaked in late December through mid-January. The remainder of the country was more like in mid to late February. Overall for the season, as we'll see on some of the surveillance slides, influenza A, H3N2 viruses were the predominant viruses. In the U.S. and throughout the world in humans, we typically see circulating influenza A, H3N2 viruses, H1N1 viruses, and B viruses. And in any given season among the A viruses, typically either H3N2s or H1N1s will predominate. This was an H3N2 season. Influenza B viruses came to be reported more frequently than the influenza A viruses from late March through early July, which is not uncommon. We'll see that on a future slide. The majority of the circulating viruses were similar to those contained in the 2016-17 vaccine. And overall activity was moderate in terms of severity, with severity indicators that were within range of what's been observed during previous influenza H2N2 predominant seasons. Next slide, please. Now, for current influenza activity, since we're getting ready to start the 17-18 season, there's not a lot we can say just yet. As of week 39, this was the calendar week ending September 30th, 2017, which was our latest surveillance report. There was low activity thus far in the United States. Surveillance reports are updated every week on Friday, and the full flu view reports that CDC produces generally start with the report that summarizes the first week in October. So the first full flu view report will be for this coming season will be out tomorrow. But so far, not a lot of activity. Next slide, please. The first two slides summarize information on surveillance of influenza positive test results, and these are reported to CDC every week by WHO surveillance laboratories that are located in all 50 states and also some territories, as well as laboratories participating in the National Respiratory and Enteric Virus Surveillance System. There are two general types of labs that report to these systems. We have basically public health labs and clinical labs, and their testing practices differ a little bit, so I'm going to present them in two separate slides. This first slide summarizes results from the clinical laboratories. Now, as we mentioned, among humans and in our current time, we generally have influenza A viruses and B viruses circulating. The A's are divided into H3N2s and H1N1s. B's are divided into two lineages that are given names, Yamagata and Victoria. The clinical laboratories in general do not subtype the A viruses and don't distinguish the lineages of the B viruses, so that's why we only have two colors on this graph. The data are summarized by calendar week on the bottom, on the x-axis, and we have two y-axes, one for the number of positive specimens, that refers to the colored bars in the graph, and the other on the right-hand side, the percent of specimens that were positive, which refers to the lines in the graph. A viruses are represented in yellow. If you consider the total season, that big peak in the middle of the graph is basically the peak of the 2016-17 season. We have more yellow overall than green. We had as is not atypical, A's predominated over B's for the season. The B viruses, you can see though, reach a peak later in the season and proportionally are during some weeks, there's actually a greater proportion of those than there are the A viruses. And this is something that we see not uncommonly, sort of a later uptick in peak in B viruses. Now, I'm going to just direct your attention to the far right of the graph, because as we move forward in weeks, we get to what you see on the last entry on the x-axis, 2017 week 38 and week 39. That is where we were towards the end of September. And if you look there, basically we have a very low number of positive specimens. And also if you look at that solid line above the bars, less than 5% of specimens submitted to these systems were positive for flu. So overall, not a lot of activity, and makes it difficult for us to predict anything about what kind of season it's going to be, what kind of viruses we're going to see, how good match is going to be, how severe it's going to be. Just really too early to tell for this season so far. Next slide, please. These are data from the same surveillance system, but this is from the public health laboratories, and most of these laboratories will sort out the A's into different subtypes and the B's by lineage, so we have a few more colors on this graph. Overwhelmingly, H3N2 viruses represented by red predominated. We see the same sort of late uptick in the B viruses that was reflected in the graphs from the other laboratories. And still, if you look at the most recent weeks, those are the weeks enclosed by the bracket going all the way out to September 30th, simply not enough activity to really make any predictions about where we're going yet for this season in the United States. Next slide, please. These are data on pneumonia and influenza mortality. The next couple of slides are going to be on mortality data. And these data come from the National Center for Health Statistics Mortality Surveillance System. This is not deaths due to laboratory-confirmed flu, but rather deaths that were associated with a pneumonia or influenza diagnosis, and most of this comes from death certificate data. We have several seasons represented. The peaks and the red lines are basically different seasons. Our most recent season, 16-17, is on the far right. We see overall a lower percent of deaths that were reported to the system that were due to pneumonia and influenza diagnoses, kind of similar to what we saw last season. There is some reporting lag with death certificate data always, so these are data that could change as we go forward through this season, and we receive more reports that were reflective of last season. Next slide. Now, this is a talk about adults, but just as a full part of a surveillance overview, these are the pediatric mortality data. Pediatric deaths associated with lab-confirmed flu have been reportable in the U.S. since 2004. So this is a mortality system where we actually do get data associated with lab-confirmed flu. For 2016-17, a total of 107 pediatric deaths were reported. We do sometimes get late reports of a given season after that season ended, so it's possible that figure could go up a bit more. And to my knowledge, we have not had reporting for the 17-18 season yet. Next slide. These are data from ILINET, which is a system through which several thousand providers in the U.S. report the percent of their visits that were due to ILI problems or influenza-like illness problems. So this is another one of those systems for which it's not lab-confirmed flu diagnoses, but ILI illness reporting does help us to get a handle on the severity of the season, and we use that in a complementary manner with the other surveillance systems we have. Several seasons are recommended here. The most recent one, 2016-17, is the red line with a little triangle superimposed on it. And we have a number of other seasons that are sort of illustrative. For example, the gray line was the 2009-10 pandemic year, which had a very early peak during the summer, and then a later peak during the fall of that season. We have a couple of super mild or relatively mild seasons. For example, if you look at the green line, which is the 2011-12 season, that actually barely broke the national baseline, which is the hash line. The national baseline is calculated based on reports of ILI during non-flu season periods of time, and the 2011-12 season didn't quite break it, except for looks like about 1 week. So overall, for the 16-17 season, we have sort of moderate ILI activity reported, similar to the 2014-15 season, which was also an H3N2 season. Next slide. This last slide summarizes hospitalization data. These are data that come from reporting both from EIP states and also Influenza Hospitalization Project states. And this is the one slide that I do have data that are broken down by age, just to give an idea of who's most affected by the by influenza in terms of hospitalizations. This is basically cumulative incidence of hospitalizations over the course of the 2016-17 season. So since it's cumulative, the number is always going to go up over the course of the season. Surveillance week is on the x-axis, and the rate of hospitalizations per 100,000 is on the y-axis. By far and away for the 16-17 season, the highest cumulative rate of hospitalization is for that green line there, which represents those 65 and older, almost 280 per 100,000. Coming in next place, we have 50 through 64-year-olds, and then after that, 0 through 4-year-olds, whom among the pediatric group are most likely to get hospitalized generally. Now, if you look at different seasons, sometimes there are relative differences. Overall, in most seasons, those 65 and older tend to have the highest hospitalization rates, though. Next slide. So that was my last surveillance slide. Just want to thank the folks on our surveillance team that put these data together every week. And you can find updated information by going to cdc.gov/flu and looking for the link to FluView. And again, those are updated every Friday. Tomorrow will be the first report of the season for 17-18. And just like to thank, acknowledge the folks who put this data together. It's quite an undertaking. Thanks very much.
Next slide, please. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner, Medical Director of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases, or the NFID. I'm also a professor of preventive medicine and infectious diseases at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. On behalf of NFID, I'm very pleased to welcome you all here this afternoon to talk about flu. And thanks to Dr. Grosskopf for providing a very informative recap of the 2016-17 flu season and for her little peek into how the current season is unfolding so far, and it's a bit early to make predictions. My presentation today will focus on three key areas. First, I'll start off by discussing the burden of influenza in the 65-plus population. And then I'll discuss the importance of a strong healthcare professional vaccine recommendation, particularly for older adults. And finally, I'll share a new toolkit recently developed by NFID, designed to help healthcare professionals talk with older adult patients about the importance of annual flu prevention. Next slide, please. And I think there we are, the learning objectives. After today's webinar, participants will be able to describe the phenomenon of immunosenescence and how the immune system grows weaker with aging, be able to discuss the importance of safe and effective influenza vaccines specifically developed for adults age 65 years and older, and have a better understanding of the resources available to help talk with adult patients about specific influenza vaccines most beneficial for them. Next slide, please. The NFID is a nonprofit 501c3 organization dedicated to educating both healthcare professionals and the public about the causes, prevention, and treatment of infectious diseases across the lifespan. For nearly 45 years, NFID has developed educational programs specifically designed to reach healthcare professionals, the public, and the media to raise awareness about infectious diseases, as well as the importance of prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. Over the years, NFID has gathered together partners in the medical and public health communities to address the many challenges of flu season. Together, we've campaigned for influenza and pneumococcal disease prevention with one strong voice. The next slide, please. And the next. So, who needs influenza vaccination? I want to start today by talking about who needs to get a flu shot. We now know the enormous toll flu takes on the entire population, as demonstrated by Dr. Grosskopf, young and old alike. So we recommend it universally every year for everyone age 6 months and older. You don't have to think about it anymore. Just give it. We have a plentiful supply of vaccine, and improvements in vaccine development continue. Later, you'll hear more about the different vaccine options available in the U.S. Essentially, everyone needs a flu shot, and there is truly no excuse to miss the vaccine and its protective value at near zero risk. It's an extraordinarily safe vaccine. Next slide, please. This slide shows, actually it doesn't show the percentage, but let's see. Let's go to the next slide. There we are. Now we're on track. This slide shows the percentage of visits for influenza-like illness, Dr. Grosskopf showed us this slide, reported to CDC for several past seasons. As you can see from the data, flu season is unpredictable, and as I like to say, if you've seen one flu season, you've seen one flu season. Note that the timing of influenza varies from season to season, and that's why it's so important to get your flu shot early before the influenza virus starts circulating. You'll also note that influenza-related illnesses affect all age groups, but those age 65 years and older have the greatest morbidity and mortality. In fact, older adults account for more than half of flu-related hospitalizations. Next slide. Unfortunately, we also see a high rate of deaths from influenza in the 65-plus age group. Older adults account for, get this, 85% of all flu-related deaths. Let me say that again, 85% of all flu-related deaths. The death rate, if you like statistics, among this population is more than six times that of the general population. It's 133 per 100,000 people. Compare that to only 20 per 100,000 people across the entire age span. The findings from the research that examined these death rates is consistent with estimates from other countries, so it's not just in the United States. Mortality rates in these other countries are also 7 to 11 times higher in those aged 65 years and older than the general population. Next slide, please. So why is that? And one of the key reasons is that older adults are particularly susceptible to flu-related complications because of the phenomenon known as immunosenescence. That fancy word, immunosenescence, refers to the gradual deterioration of the immune system due to aging. As a result, the weakening immune system makes it harder for our bodies to combat disease and may decrease the immune response to standard influenza vaccines. Next slide, please. As I've noted, adults age 65 and older are at increased risk of flu-related complications because of their age, but those with chronic diseases may face an even higher risk of complications. For those patients who take, for example, immunosuppressive drugs to treat chronic conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis, they have a decreased ability to prevent or fight off infections, making them more susceptible to illnesses and their complications such as flu. But even without the immunosuppressive drugs, the CDC places individuals with chronic medical conditions in a high-risk category, and this includes asthma, lung disease, heart disease, diabetes, and others. And we know that the 65-plus population also is more likely to have these chronic medical conditions, so reinforcing the value of immunization is essential for these patients who are older. Next slide, please. On this slide, I've listed the safe and effective influenza vaccines specifically designed for people who are 65 years of age and older. Adjuvanted and high-dose vaccines both are designed to overcome the effects of an aging immune system, producing an improved immune response. Both of these vaccines are licensed specifically for this age group by the Food and Drug Administration. Next slide, please. Although both of the vaccines on the previous slide are specifically designed for older adults, I want to highlight the recommendations from CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the ACIP. Because the flu virus can evolve and flu vaccines are updated each season, ACIP recommends routine annual influenza vaccination for all individuals aged 6 months and older with a licensed age-appropriate vaccines. Importantly, older adults should not delay their vaccination to find a particular product if an appropriate one is available. In other words, any appropriate flu vaccine is better than not getting vaccinated. A vaccine deferred is often a vaccine not received. Next slide, please. And the next. I'd like to shift gears slightly now to discuss the role that we healthcare professionals play in ensuring that older adult patients do get vaccinated against influenza. Based on my own experience, as well as results from a recent survey, older adults are more likely to get a flu shot if it is recommended by their doctor. Now, a strong recommendation is essential to ensuring that older adults understand the importance of annual flu vaccination and specific vaccines beneficial to them. And this shouldn't just happen at an annual physical, but at every opportunity we have to make the recommendation to our patients. Let's take advantage of every opportunity. Next slide. While many of us think about the role family physicians and pharmacists play in vaccination, specialists also may have many opportunities to discuss flu vaccines with their patients. Outpatient visits to specialists present an excellent but often missed opportunity to provide the vaccine if the office stocks it, or to recommend that the patients receive it at another site that has the vaccine. Especially since patients may not see their primary care physician during flu season, their only touch point with the system may be with a specialist. So providing patients with take-home information or a prescription for an influenza vaccine can encourage them to follow through with vaccination more than a recommendation alone. And of course, practicing specialists and office staff, and I would say everyone with patient contact, should also be immunized to protect the patients, of course, as well as themselves. But it's basically a patient safety issue. So I think it is both a professional and a kind of a moral obligation almost for all healthcare providers to be vaccinated so we don't transmit influenza to our patients. In the next slide, please. This slide summarizes some key takeaways. First, influenza is a key contributor to morbidity and mortality in older adults. It's a major contributor. I mentioned that older adults account for more than half of flu-related hospitalizations and the majority of influenza-associated deaths during most annual epidemics. Importantly, even if they recover, older adults may never fully regain their pre-influenza health and abilities, significantly impacting their lifestyle, their capacity to perform the activities of daily living may actually be diminished and may not get back to their baseline pre-influenza. Older adults with chronic conditions are at even higher risk for flu-related hospitalizations, complications, and death. And finally, a point very important to me that I'd like to reiterate, healthcare professionals should strongly encourage. In fact, I think healthcare professionals should be vaccine insisters that their patients age 65 and older be vaccinated. Next slide, please. So let's look at the next slide. I'd like to provide a brief overview of a new toolkit that the NFIB launched, designed to help healthcare professionals talk to patients 65 and older. The title of the campaign is Care About Older Adults, Care About Flu, underscoring the fact that all healthcare professionals who care for older adults play a critical role. If we could go back to the last slide then, because we've also created, as part of this toolkit, a public service announcement. And we're now going to give you an opportunity to have a look at it. Well, let's see if we can go back a couple of
flu slides. Can be serious for everyone. But for adults age 65 years and older, the risk of serious complications is high. Immune systems weaken with age, making it harder to fight disease. The good news is there are specifically designed influenza vaccines available to help protect older adults against flu. Talk to patients age 65 and older about the importance of annual flu vaccination and specific vaccines most beneficial for them. Care for older adults? Care about flu.
There we go. Pretty snappy. Let's look at the next slide. Thank you. So in addition to the PSA, the toolkit includes an infographic, a fact sheet, an email template, and on hold for your phone scripts to help healthcare professionals and office staff be better prepared for the flu season. We've also created a poster or handout for patients, which includes a quiz so older adults can learn flu facts and ask about the vaccine most beneficial for them. Next slide, please. And this is my last slide. So all of these free resources are available online at www.nfid.org/flu65. There it is on the screen, along with a link to a recording of the webinar we offered last month that goes into more detail on many of the topics covered today. Thank you for inviting me to present here today on behalf of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. And now I'll turn the program back over to Chandra to kick off the Q&A session.
Thank you, presenters, for providing our COCA audience with a wealth of information. We will now go into our Q&A session. Please remember, you may submit questions through the webinar system by clicking the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen and then typing your question. Now for our first question. Based on last season, do you have any idea about what this current flu season will be like?
This is Lisa. We do not. It's rather early. As you can see, we have relatively, from those first slides we showed with the graphs of the different kind of viruses that are isolated, right now the activity is low enough that we can't really predict at this point what's going to be predominant, nor really how severe a season it's going to be, how early it's going to start and peak. More to come on that.
But Lisa, fair enough. This is Bill. We can predict there will be a flu season.
That typically happens. I mean, there are some seasons where things get off to kind of a late start and, you know, activity is relatively low. For example, one of the seasons we showed for 2011-12, a relatively mild season. And sometimes things like that happen where, you know, it was actually kind of hard to tell exactly where the peak was for a little while. But we can predict there will be one, yes.
Sure. And the reason I'm teasing a little bit is because we shouldn't kind of try to predict and then decide whether to get vaccinated, right?
That's
no
correct.
Just
that's,
get vaccinated
that,
provide
that's
the best protection, right?
Absolutely.
There you go.
Thank you, Dr. Groskopf and Dr. Schaffner. My second question, is there any merit to giving two doses of influenza vaccines to patients, one early in the season and one later on?
That's one of the questions I get the most. There is some debate regarding how long protection from flu vaccine lasts, but there are no data to support giving more than one flu vaccine in a season. And at the moment, there are no recommendations from the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices or any other group for so-called boosting or re-immunizing during the flu season. The most important advice I would give to everyone, including older adults, is to get that influenza vaccine. Now's the time to do it. And regardless of which type of vaccine is available, take the one that your provider has available. Are you up for that, Lisa?
Agree.
Thank you both. Our next question. Could you comment on vaccine efficacy, particularly the fact that vaccines may provide partial protection and reduce the severity of complications?
That's a favorite question of mine. Thank you. So I'll jump in. They do provide complete protection, but they also provide partial protection and reduce the severity of the disease. That's absolutely true. Even if patients do get sick, they often are not, sick enough to go to the emergency room and be hospitalized. So the vaccine and these additional benefits, that is reducing the severity, are not measured in the usual effectiveness data that we see reported for influenza vaccine. As a matter of fact, when my patients tell me that they were vaccinated and nonetheless got a case of flu, I always tell them that I'm so happy that they were here to complain. They didn't have to go to the hospital, and certainly they didn't die. The vaccine isn't perfect. Patients may still get the flu, but it won't be as bad. As I often do, I like to quote that old French philosopher Voltaire, "Waiting for perfection is the great enemy of the current good." We have pretty darn good vaccines, and we can do a lot of good with them. In the meantime, our colleagues in the research laboratories are working to make a better vaccine, but the one we have is the one we need to use right now this year.
Thank you, Dr. Schaffner. Our next question. Can you please discuss the difference in informed consent, written consent, and signed consent? Many providers still think that a patient or designee signature is required to give vaccine. Also, the vaccine information sheet and how vaccination should be documented in the patient's medical record.
Well, Lisa can comment on this too, but I think it's always very important to put the information into your medical record, and many of the state vaccine registries will now accept information, vaccine administration information that's given to adult patients. The registries originally were established really to help pediatricians and family doctors manage vaccinations in children, but increasingly, it's not perfect yet, but increasingly these registries are also accepting information on adult immunizations.
Thank you, Dr. Schaffner. Our next question. Do you anticipate the CDC or ACIP to make a firm recommendation on use of high-dose vaccine for those 65 years or older?
You want me to take that one?
Please do, Lisa.
Okay. So as I'm sure everybody's realized that over the last few years, we've had a pretty big expansion in the number of different kinds of influenza vaccines available. Particularly if you look at the inactivated vaccines. And we've had the high-dose vaccine available since 2009, and that's licensed for 65 and older. And then more recently, we've had the adjuvanted vaccine, which is also in the U.S. anyway, licensed for 65 and older. Both of these vaccines were developed with the idea of having a better immune response in individuals, older adults who, as Bill pointed out in his presentation, for whom the immune system doesn't respond as robustly as it previously did. It does present sort of a complicated picture for providers. One of the difficult things is that we don't have a lot of data on these vaccines comparing them with one against another. So some of the exceptions are for the high-dose vaccine, there was a very large randomized trial comparing the high-dose vaccine against standard-dose trivalent vaccine that found about a 24.2% better effectiveness. Very big study, two seasons. There are data from a much smaller study for the adjuvanted vaccine, comparing that vaccine to a standard dose unadjuvanted inactivated trivalent vaccine, and it was an analysis only on about 227 people compared to 32,000 for the high dose study. And it showed better relative effectiveness there. That was an observational study, not a randomized study. What we like to see is randomized trials that will indicate, provide very strong evidence that one vaccine is more effective than another. For this particular age group, while it's a really active area of research and one that I think is going to continue to expand, right now we can say that there is some data that the high-dose vaccine works better, and that does come from a large RCT, but ACIP does not express a preference. And some of the reasons for that are that sometimes preferences, when they exist, can delay somebody getting vaccinated. For example, if they're trying to get a specific product when one is readily available, they delay vaccination and don't get vaccinated at all. So, you know, I could never predict what the ACIP will do. However, there is an expanded discussion this season on the data for vaccines for older adults that you can find in the 2017-18 influenza statement from ACIP. And the data describing the different kinds of studies and how they were designed is summarized in a table, which makes it, I think, a bit easier to digest. I guess the short answer really is can't predict when or if that will happen, but there is a lot of data summarized in the recs for providers to help them make a decision.
Thank you, Dr. Groskopf. Next question. Are there any data from Australia's winter this year?
You want to start with that, Lisa?
There are some data indicating that they had a relatively severe season. We don't receive their surveillance data, so I don't really have a lot that I can say in detail about that. In general, though, we can't necessarily assume that a severe southern hemisphere season is going to mean that we have a season that matches in severity. It doesn't necessarily follow. So I think that's one of the main reasons folks are interested in that question.
And fair enough, their H3N2 virus, which caused a fair amount of flu in Australia during our summer, actually is a pretty darn good match to what's currently in the vaccine. Mm-hmm. So if that virus comes back to bite us, we should have a good vaccine to combat it.
Yeah, I think another thing that's important to consider, in addition to geographic variability, for example, in the U.S. or in any other large geographical area, in the types of viruses that might predominate, there can be differences in the severity, differences in when the season peaks and has its onset and its fall. So even in the United States, we don't necessarily expect to see the same thing everywhere.
Yes, you made that point very nicely right at the beginning of your talk, Lisa, that flu doesn't affect the entire United States simultaneously. It can begin in any one part of the country and then move to another part of the country. So while one part of the country is getting over their flu outbreak, it can just start up in other parts of the country. So flu is fickle.
Yes, it is.
Thank you both. Our next question, is the quadrivalent vaccine available for older adults? Also, is the mortality from influenza B also more severe in older adults?
Lisa, go ahead.
The first part, the quadrivalent vaccine, is there one available for older adults?
Yeah.
Okay. There, yes. There are a large number of quadrivalent vaccines that are on the market, and most of those are approved for those 65 and older. An exception would be Fluzone intradermal quadrivalent. That's the intradermal vaccine with the very, very tiny needle that doesn't go into the muscle, but it's injected intradermally into the skin. That is licensed currently only for people aged 18 through 64 years. But there are a good number of quadrivalent intramuscular inactivated vaccines, and also the recombinant vaccine, Flublok, is appropriate for people 65 and older. If you're looking specifically at either the adjuvanted vaccine, Fluad, or the high-dose vaccine, Fluzone High-Dose. Those are the two vaccines we talked about a few minutes ago that are specifically licensed for ages 65 and older. Those are currently trivalent vaccines. And that's how they were developed. The development of vaccines is determined by manufacturers. So it's not something that CDC directs. It's conceivable in the future, though, that we may have quadrivalent versions of both of those vaccines. Probably questions about the ifs and whens of that are probably best directed to the manufacturer. For right now, though, those two specific vaccines are trivalent vaccines. With regard to influenza B, influenza B can affect anybody, and anybody can get seriously ill from it. There are some authors who have noted that it seems to be responsible for a disproportionate degree of severe illness and mortality in children. As we get older, we tend to be more likely to have been exposed to, of course, more flu each flu season and more flu vaccine. So we're exposed to the different lineages of the B viruses more often, and that may be why that is. But it does present an interesting question to providers. Do I go for, you know, the high-dose vaccine, which is trivalent, or the adjuvanted, which is trivalent, or should I be using a quadrivalent vaccine? At present, there really just isn't enough data to be able to say, you know, which of those would be a better choice. We just don't have comparative data. For example, high-dose trivalent versus standard-dose quadrivalent. So no preference is expressed.
Thank you, Dr. Groskopf.
Yeah, so I'll just I'm smiling here. I'll just give you a personal footnote on both of those issues. I know that the high dose company, the company that makes the high dose vaccine, currently has a quadrivalent formulation under study. I know because I'm a volunteer in that study. So I don't know yet whether I got the standard high dose or the experimental high dose quad, but that information will be forthcoming, hopefully, by next season. And apropos of the severity of flu B, years ago I had, despite vaccination, late season flu B. I can tell you, it makes you severely ill. So continue, please.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Schaffner. Do we know how effective our flu vaccines were last year? A few years ago, we were under 20%, and then the next year was much better. What about last year?
Go ahead, Lisa.
For last year, the data, at least from the CDC system, the U.S. Influenza Vaccine Effectiveness Network, which is a network of five geographical areas that's been using a case control design type study to evaluate VE for the last several years. For 2016-17, the overall effectiveness against all influenza for all age groups was about 42%. So not 20%, but, you know, we'd like it higher, but definitely better than 20. 40% is not uncharacteristic for H3N2 seasons, which tend to have a bit lower efficacy than H1N1 seasons. And you know, we're hoping as the season goes on to get as early as possible as an estimate for the 17-18 season. But effectiveness is going to vary based on a number of factors. Match would be one of them. For example, we had during the 14-15 season some drift in the H3N2 viruses so that there was some difference between the vaccine virus and what was circulating. So not as good an effectiveness there as you would anticipate. And also, as was brought out during Dr. Schaffner's presentation, older adults tend not to have as high an effectiveness as younger adults, mainly because of changes in the immune system.
And I always like to add the footnote, as I did in my talk previously, I'll just hit you over the head with it again, that the effectiveness data don't measure partial effectiveness. That is
very true.
Reductions in severity. And I always have to remind providers and through them patients that partial protection is still a very good thing.
Thank you both. Our next question, would someone with cancer or any other immunosuppressed system be able to take advantage of the vaccine, the 65 and older vaccine? Pardon me.
So if you're 65 years of age and older and have any chronic medical condition, of course, you can take advantage of both the high-dose vaccine and the adjuvanted vaccine. They are both inactivated vaccines, and there are really very, very few throughout the age span contraindications to influenza vaccine. The vaccines are safe. You may not get optimal protection, but we hope that the vaccine provides, at the very least, partial protection for against influenza. So absolutely, if you have cancer, that's all the more reason to get vaccinated.
Thank you, Dr. Schaffner. And for immunosuppressed people, should they take two shots?
Well, we've been down that road before. There are no data that would lead to a recommendation that someone gets either two shots initially or one shot now and another, for example, in January. I must say that's a frequently asked question, but at the moment, there are no recommendations in that regard.
Thank you, Dr. Schaffner. Our next question. There was a recent article suggesting that receiving annual influenza vaccinations may lead to decreasing efficacy for subsequent years. Are you aware of any studies which provide more information about this?
Lisa, do you want to get into that?
Sure. It's something that has been noted in some studies, not consistently in every study. So it's a finding that is hopefully going to be characterized a little bit better over the next few years. It hasn't been consistently observed, though. So at the present time, the recommendation still stands to get vaccinated every year.
Indeed, and everyone agrees to that.
Okay, thank you. What is the recommended vaccination rate in long-term care facilities to limit the chances of an outbreak occurring?
Well, I would hope that in any kind of healthcare facility, but particularly these residential facilities, that we vaccinate all of the people who reside there as well as all the caregivers. And that will reduce the risk of introducing influenza into the facility and spreading within the facility. Lisa, would you like to underline that?
Yeah, there's not an absolute percent threshold that I'm aware of. Basically,
right.
Though everyone 6 months of age and older who doesn't have a contraindication is recommended to get vaccinated, and that's particularly important for people who are in groups that are at high risk for severe illness if they get the flu. So individuals that are, you know, particularly older who have chronic medical conditions, debilitated, and in, for example, long-term care facilities and nursing homes would be in that group. So while there's no threshold, we basically, you know, would recommend that everybody be vaccinated.
And, you know, when you look at the risk-benefit equation, there's essentially no risk. So give the vaccine to everyone.
Thank you both. If you are 66 and take care of children in a healthcare setting, should you take a high-dose flu vaccine or a quadrivalent vaccine?
I think that's
good question.
That's the most frequently asked question I get for people age 65 and older. Is it quad or high-dose or adjuvanted? And I guess I would recommend that everyone talk to their healthcare providers, and you providers look at the information in the ACIP guidance and make up your own minds, but don't let the person leave unvaccinated. Lisa?
I would agree.
Thank you both. Next question. I understand that influenza is unpredictable. Could you comment on the influenza strains that are expected to predominate during the 2017-2018 season?
So they're asking us to look at our crystal balls, and Lisa already said they're cloudy. We can't tell you.
Yeah, and one of the difficulties is that because there needs to be adequate time to produce vaccine, the surveillance data that's reviewed from around the world in making determinations for what should be in the Northern Hemisphere vaccine are those meetings and discussions are held in February or March of each year. And then the Southern Hemisphere, they make that determination of September, you know, for a season in the Southern Hemisphere that is going to be not until the following summer. So we have a situation in which the data and the assessments need to be made months in advance of the season starting. And sometimes things do change because influenza viruses do constantly change by the time the season actually begins in the Northern Hemisphere. You know, at this point, you know, I basically think what we can say that was what was expected to be the most likely to circulate predominantly would be the vaccine viruses that were selected for the vaccine. But it's way too early to know at this point whether or not what we see in the U.S. going forward in the next 4 to 6 months is going to be an exact match to what was there.
And, you know, the influenza vaccine is multivalent in part for that same reason. There are always several influenza virus strains circulating. And so the vaccines cover both A strains and B strains. And so you have a multi-purpose vaccine, really. This goes to the question also that I'm sometimes asked. Well, the patient didn't get vaccinated and they tell me they've already had the flu. Should I give them the vaccine? Well, two things about that. Well, whatever respiratory virus they had, maybe it was flu or maybe it wasn't, so you can't be sure. And of course, there are multiple influenza viruses circulating, so it's important to get vaccinated regardless.
Okay, thank you both. That concludes our Q&A session. On behalf of COCA, I would like to thank everyone for joining us today, with a special thank you to our presenters, Dr. Lisa Groskopf and Dr. William Schaffner. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted within the next few days on the COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. All continuing education for COCA calls are issued online through TCE Online, the CDC Training and Continuing Education online system at www.cdc.gov/TCE Online. Those who participated in today's COCA call and would like to receive continuing education should complete the online evaluation by November 12, 2017, and use course code WC2286. Those who will review the call on demand and would like to receive continuing education should complete the online evaluation between October 12, 2017 and October 12, 2019, and use course code WD2286. Please join us for our next COCA call. The role of primary care providers in supporting children, families, and themselves following Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria. This call will be held on Thursday, October 26, 2017. To receive information on upcoming COCA calls or other COCA products and services, please visit the COCA webpage at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA and join COCA's mailing list. To stay connected to the latest news from COCA, be sure to like and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/CDC Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity. Again, thank you all for being a part of today's COCA call. Have a great day.